Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ziprecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Get everything for your next project at Menards and save big money. We carry everything to help you breathe easier. Allergen air filters help prevent seasonal allergy symptoms and improve your indoor air quality by capturing microparticles while allowing maximum airflow. Save big on allergen air filters when you shop at Menards. View the weekly flyer and all of our great deals happening this week on Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
You've been listening to Spoiled Fruit, Faith and Power. This is Chapter 8. And if you've made it this far, thank you. You've stuck with us through some of the hardest stories we've ever told. Last episode, we focused on the leadership of Jay Pathick, his rise through the Vineyard system, the mentorship he received from Rich Nathan, and the culture he built at Mile High Vineyard in Denver, a culture where spiritual language was often used to bypass real accountability, and where those who raised concerns were systematically silenced, discredited, or pushed out. We examined how Jay's style of leadership mirrored the same abusive patterns we saw with Michael and Brenda Gatlin in Duluth and Alan and Catherine Scott in Anaheim. We looked at how Vineyard USA responded to warning signs, not by intervening, but by reinforcing the same flawed structures that made abuse possible. And now, in this final chapter, we step back to look at the bigger picture. How did Vineyard USA use real crisis to consolidate power? What systems were broken long before any scandal made headlines? And what would it take, not just to repair the damage, but to build something better? Because what happens next is up to you. At first glance, the reorg looked like a response to crisis. The Duluth scandal had just exploded. Anaheim Vineyard had severed ties with the movement. Trust in national leadership was crumbling. Something had to be done. But what most people didn't realize is that the reorg wasn't a reaction. It had been planned for years, long before Duluth or Anaheim imploded. And instead of pausing to understand the root causes of these crises, Vineyard USA used them as leverage to push through a transformation they had already decided on behind closed doors. The messaging was clear. The house is on fire. We have to act fast. Behind the scenes, national leadership was finalizing a sweeping restructuring plan, one that would centralize power, reduce local church autonomy, and cement national authority with minimal input from the people it would affect most. It wasn't just tone deaf, it was strategic.
I'd like to ask Todd, is Todd and Debbie Hunter, who were at one point national directors of the Vineyard. They're here to participate with us. God bless you. Thank you, Todd and Debbie. Years and years of service. Of course, Bert and Evelyn were invited in COVID and health. They weren't able to come.
That's former national director Phil Strout, standing next to Jay and Danielle Pathick on stage at a national conference, a moment meant to symbolize unity and continuity. But the truth?
My dad is my hero, former national director of the Vineyard. Several years ago, he did not attend the national conference. The official word that was put out by Jay at the national conference was that my dad was sick and couldn't come. The questions began to arise when pictures of my dad fishing on Facebook the week of the national conference seemed to challenge that that suggestion. This was post-COVID. That is not the reason my dad did not attend the national conference. That as a former national director, he has had serious concerns about what is going on with this whole transition, what's been going on with, you know, Duluth, what's been going on in the consolidation of power through the reorg. And he has been put out to pasture in the vineyard. And so he didn't have a voice. Very few people contact him. Lots of people say they respect him. But when he became a voice, even a former national director became a casualty of this power grab. And that hurts me tremendously. But I think it speaks volumes about the leadership of this movement right now. And all I'm asking is for vineyard pastors to ask questions and make decisions for yourself that, trust me, is not an answer. Trust me is a deflection, right? Trust me should cause significant, it should cause you to question even further, is what I would say.
This wasn't just a miscommunication. It was a lie, told publicly in front of pastors from across the country. And it was used to reinforce a power structure already in motion. With the reorg narrative in place, Vineyard USA moved to manufacture consent, first through a national survey, then through what was presented as an objective institutional assessment. But both were deeply flawed. The survey was framed as a listening exercise, a chance for pastors and churches to shape the future of the movement. But in reality, the participation rate was low. Many pastors reported never receiving it. The questions were vague, leading, and poorly designed. And the results? Never fully published. Rather than reflecting the voice of the movement, the survey confirmed what leadership already wanted to hear. It served as a smokescreen of legitimacy for changes that had been planned long before most churches knew a reorganization was even being discussed. Then came the institutional assessment. It was commissioned by Vineyard USA to evaluate the national structure, but the scope was narrow and the process suspect. The consultant hired to conduct it was reportedly in a financially vulnerable position, relying on the contract to help support a sick spouse. The assessment avoided hard questions about abuse response, leadership accountability, and theological diversity. And most notably, the assessment's recommendations closely mirrored a confidential reorg memo drafted by national leadership back in 2020, years before Duluth or Anaheim. Same solutions, same structure, different packaging. This wasn't a neutral assessment. It was reinforcement, the appearance of reform built on pre-selected conclusions. And when pastors and leaders asked questions about any of it, the response wasn't dialogue. It was control. When people raised questions about the reorg, about the survey, the assessment, or the sudden centralization of power, they weren't met with conversation. They were met with silence, or worse, spiritual bypass. Here's religious trauma expert Dr. Paula Swindle.
Churches that have a lot of what we call spiritual bypass, and you're probably familiar with that term. So it's one of the things that it's hard to describe, but you know it when you see it a little bit. So it's basically operating only at that spiritual religious level to the exclusion of the cognitive or the psychological or the emotional. So the kind of, you know it when you see it, is when someone says, oh, just pray more. You're just not praying hard enough. Or when someone is grieving, to say, you shouldn't grieve there in heaven. You should be happy. So it really dismisses this experience of struggle, dismisses an experience of trauma, dismisses an experience of grief, to where, you know, it's healthy to think, you can believe two things. You can believe someone's in heaven and you can grieve and be sad that they're not with you. Like, those are not mutually exclusive things. But spiritual bypass it's toxic positivity in a spiritual form.
For those who weren't silenced by spiritual bypass, Vineyard USA had another tool, retaliation. And no story illustrates that more clearly than what happened to Reagan Wagoner. Reagan is a longtime Vineyard pastor and the son of former national director Burt Wagoner. He's been in the movement for decades, respected, measured, faithful. But when he began asking questions about the reorg, about the lack of transparency, the top-down control, and the suppression of dissent, he was branded a problem.
Jay is a really nice guy. Anybody's been around Jay, super nice guy, and he's a winsome personality, and he was every bit of that in our meeting. He was never mean. He was none of that. But he did at one point, as I'm continuing to push and ask questions, he said, well, I need to be very frank about something. There are a lot of pastors in your region that have issues with you, that have problems with you, and you don't have trust from these pastors in your region. And laid into me and sort of lectured me for, you know, it felt like 30 minutes, maybe it was 10 minutes, I don't know, but it was very clear the point he was making is that nobody likes me, pastors have an issue with you, this is a problem. And I was, the wind was taken out of me. I don't know that I heard a whole lot more that happened in that conversation after that, because I was on my way out as senior pastor. I was going into academics. I was on my home stretch. These relationships were really important to me. And, you know, here's somebody saying, yeah, all the people that you think like you, they don't like you. And so after the meeting was done, I met with my executive pastor who was in the meeting, and I said, did I hear this right? I just need to make sure, because it seemed like he was really clear. Tell me. And they said, yeah, that's absolutely what he said. And I just couldn't believe it. So I sent three emails out that evening, one to Jay Pathak, one to Joel Seymour, and one to Jim Harrington, asking for clarification about that statement. And what I asked Jim, because he had done all of the interviews in our region, was, hey, did you hear something that I haven't heard? Is there something that came through these interviews? Like, what's going on? And he replied back pretty quickly, same night or the next morning, none of that came from me. I never heard that from anybody I interviewed in all of the interviews I did in your region. Okay. Joel, did that come from you? Joel said, I don't know what that's about, right? I've got these emails, by the way, their responses, like, I don't know what that was about. Jay never replied until a week later. During that week, I got on the phone and I called every pastor that I had as much as an email encounter with in our region. Some of these people I've known for 20 plus years. Some I drove out of town to go visit with them, to hang out with them. And, you know, in 20 years, yeah, you do have conflicts with some pastors and you work it out. That's what relationships are. But I wanted to make sure, like, is there anything out there? And to a person, everyone that I met with said, absolutely, there is nothing. In fact, just the opposite. You know, I just have so much respect and I value our relationship and et cetera, et cetera. It's what I had hoped for and what I thought was the case. But it turned out to be absolutely not true, not validated by anybody. Now, this isn't abuse at the level that we've seen from Duluth, right, and the Gatlins. This is not that level. I make no claim towards that. In the moment, it was deeply painful and hard, and Jay didn't reply, and so I finally sent a second email to him a week later after I'd spent the entire week calling, visiting, everything I could with pastors, and said, this is abuse of power, what you did. And the reply I got back to him was, this was being pushed, something like, I'm a man of authority, and so are you, and this is going to go to the executive whatever team, right? The big giant head. Oh, so I get a letter from Tom Campion and Michael Gatlin saying that they're going to investigate this. And by the way, I had no idea this entity existed. I couldn't find it anywhere, but, you know, finally found out and I get this email. And I said, yes, I would like to tell my story. Here's my conditions. I would like to have a disinterested third party in our conversations, because I don't want anything misrepresented about what's going on, because there's a lot of that going on. So I don't want anything. And they sort of mocked me on it a little bit. Like, what do you mean? And Tom volunteered to be the disinterested third party. What part of... So they said no, they wouldn't do it. And I said, okay, I will come your way a little bit. Here's my second offer. Have each party present their full account of what happened. I'll submit mine along with the emails that I got in return, and that those be included in the report. I'll do it if we do that. I never heard back until I got their final report saying that they had found that Jay was not in any error because they had talked to Jim and they had talked to Joel. That was enough. My executive pastor, they had asked to talk to as well. My executive pastor said, I won't do it without a disinterested third party. And they sort of mocked us in that email. And in that email, let me see, there were several names they called me in that email. They said I was emotional. They said I was lacking self-awareness. They said I was defensive, hypersensitive, and exaggerating. And they said, without self-awareness, it's unlikely that the defensiveness will dissolve as Reagan continues to look outwardly as a victim and less inwardly to what changes he can make better to better a situation. This was their official report. So they had refused to investigate this matter with reasonable protections in place to ensure any kind of fairness. They never addressed the actual charge that I presented regarding what Jay had done, except just in generalities, and they impugned me and attacked my character.
They didn't investigate the charge. They didn't seek the truth. They discredited the messenger. And Reagan wasn't alone.
There's a lot of proactive work on the end of the leaders to keep people quiet and keep people in line. And, you know, the threat of ostracization, the threat of, you know, being outed from that system is huge. So there's a big kind of prevention work being done for people to speak up to begin with. But if someone does, ooh, that's when there's an immediate squashing of that, if possible. There's a lot of scapegoating of that person and gaslighting to try to put the blame back on that person. So yes, there's kind of that twofold. There's the let's prep the people to stay silent and in line. And when they don't, let's show other people why they don't want to do this.
This is how systems protect themselves. They redefine dissent as a personal flaw. They make the person asking questions feel crazy, unstable, or divisive. They weaponize emotional language to discredit the truth.
I think those three things are the Vineyard system, and we wonder how a Gatlin kind of situation can happen. It's because Gatlin on the executive team writing a report representing the national director, how they handle situations that were brought up, that's what they do, right? They don't investigate the matter with reasonable protections in place. They don't address the issue that's being charged, and they impugn and attack the character of the person who brought it up. My issue was small, but that is the system. That's the bed we've made as a Vineyard. That structure, that organization is what's asking for more power right now, and that is toxic and deeply problematic.
Reagan wasn't asking for special treatment. He wasn't pushing a theological agenda. He was asking for process, for fairness, for basic accountability. And that was enough to get him pushed out. So where do we go from here? Because if you've made it this far, you're probably asking the same question we are. What would it take to stop this from happening again? To answer that, we didn't just point fingers, we did the work. Over the past several months, we ran independent assessments of Vineyard's governance structures, both at the national level and the local church level. What we found were deep systemic flaws baked into the framework. Boards stacked with handpicked friends, no meaningful term limits, no independent HR, no protections for whistleblowers, no clear process for holding national leaders accountable. And at the local level, circular reporting, married co-leadership with unchecked power.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
And bylaws that leave congregations vulnerable. You can read those assessments for yourself. We've made them available on our website. Free, public, and open to any church that wants to understand what's broken. But we didn't stop at analysis. We drafted actual policy proposals, a roadmap for reform that Vineyard USA is free to adopt, adapt, or build on. a job description for a truly independent national HR consultant, someone empowered to receive and investigate complaints without conflict of interest, a trauma-informed abuse reporting system with protections for survivors and a process that doesn't loop back to the abuser's inner circle, a reformed national leadership election process that gives real voice to local churches, an independent ethics board, not one made up of the same people under investigation or their closest allies. These aren't radical ideas. They're the bare minimum for an organization that wants to be credible, safe, and spirit-led. And yes, reform means everyone gives something up. Local churches may have to relinquish some autonomy, but the national office must stop behaving like a closed circle and start submitting to the people it claims to serve. Because accountability isn't the enemy of revival. It's the soil revival grows in. The Vineyard doesn't have to start from scratch. In fact, other denominations have already built the structures that Vineyard so desperately needs. One of them is the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, or ELCA. Now let's be clear, no denomination is perfect. But when it comes to accountability, transparency, and representation, the ELCA offers a working model that Vineyard would do well to learn from. Here's how it works. National leadership is elected, not appointed by insiders, but through a formal voting process involving both clergy and lay representatives from local churches. Bishops and presiding officers serve defined terms, and answer not to handpicked boards, but to elected regional councils called synods. Policies are publicly debated and voted on during a biannual church-wide assembly. And perhaps most importantly, there are clear checks and balances. No one person holds ultimate authority. Here's ELCA Lutheran pastor Doug Warburton talking about the role of bishops.
There is, we have bishops, and the bishop has staff. And so pastors, Basically, there's oversight from these bishops, and the bishop's role is, among other things, one of the things that a bishop does is monitors and makes sure that pastors are living up to the calling that they've been called to. And so I know this goes toward your story. It's when a pastor acts out of line and is not living up to those callings, that's when a bishop can come in and do some disciplinary actions. But bishops help oversee congregations. They have a lot of different roles other than that. In the ELCA, disclosure is crucial. Being able to, and the bishop sees themselves as an advocate for the victims. And so one of the great things about the role of being a bishop is that there is someone for victims to go and talk to and try to get some sort of remedy to what's taking place in the congregation. And so disclosure being so important, and I have here a little document from the ELCA that talks about that, and I underlined this paragraph here as it talks about disclosure and why it's made to the congregation. And I love how this is worded. Only through disclosure can the church invite healing for victims, both known and unknown, and for members of the congregation who experience the pain of betrayal. Cover-ups are like toxic dumps with poison seeping out for years afterward, making healing very difficult. And I just thought that that seems critical in when there's allegations made against a religious leader in any way, shape, or form. It needs to be disclosed, even if it's still being investigated, just so the congregation is aware of what's happening. So if this were to take place in the ELCA and a bishop came to one of their pastors and said, this allegation has been made against you, the pastor has two choices. He or she can argue against it, or they can admit to it. And if they argue against it, the bishop can, depending on the evidence that's been presented, the bishop can either recommend resignation and being removed from the denomination, or if the pastor refuses, then there can be a trial. And so it all is part of the disciplinary proceedings. But yeah, going back to your question, disclosure just so important, being able to communicate up front what's taking place.
Unlike Vineyard, where leadership often avoids action until public pressure forces it, the ELCA builds accountability into the bones of its governance. But that's not all. The ELCA also places a high value on education and formation.
First thing you would do is you determine which seminary you were interested in. So for me, it was Trinity Seminary, your old home, childhood home. That's and right. And so then they let you know what the steps are, and each seminary is the same, but there's a candidacy process. And one of the first things you do is you take a mental stability test, and just to make sure that each area has a different company that they use to conduct that, and just to make sure that you're...
So it's a third-party company.
Yeah, that they bring in, and just to make sure that you're a healthy candidate for ministry and that you're going to be a benefit to the church as opposed to a detriment. And so then you go, when you've been accepted into seminary, and then throughout your time as a seminarian, so it's a four-year, the longest master's degree I think there is out there,
yeah.
4 years master's degree, when I was there, it was 3 years of school, mm-hmm. classwork, and 1 year of internship. But each year you meet with your candidacy committee, and they evaluate how you've done. Are you serving well? Are you serving healthy? And then the last year is the approval process. And depending on who your candidacy committee is, that can be a fairly pleasant process or that can be a brutal process. Because there are pastors involved, there are lay people involved, and they just kind of drill you with questions, making sure that you've met the requirements of what it means to be an ELCA pastor. And it's one of those procedures that they just try to make sure that what we're bringing into the church is going to best serve the church. You don't want to take away the sense that people are called to something and that God can work through people in all sorts of different ways. But there are definitely benefits to having some education, to bringing some sort of contextual understanding to things. And we learned a lot about scripture, of course, and what's in the Bible, where the Bible, we had to take Greek and just to kind of understand how it's difficult to translate into English.
Yeah.
There are certain passages that are just really challenging. And so the reason they had us take Greek is just to understand that there is no perfect translation. Every translation is somebody's idea of what it says. And so just developing an understanding of that. We also took some counseling classes, learn, how, if you're going to do pastoral counseling, how do you do that healthy? How do you make sure that you're not doing harm in that? And so there's a number of different leadership classes, things like that, that were extremely helpful in learning what does it look like to be a healthy pastor.
In the Vineyard, seminary is often dismissed as unnecessary or even a threat to spirit-led leadership. But in a world where churches are grappling with abuse, trauma, and deep emotional wounds, pastors need more than passion. They need preparation. The ELCA doesn't fear questions. It creates space for them. It doesn't demand uniformity. It allows for theological diversity. And most importantly, it centers the needs of the people it serves, not the image of the leaders at the top. So why is Vineyard, this movement that once prided itself on freedom and innovation, so afraid of accountability? Throughout this series, we followed a devastating pattern. Abusive leaders protected. Survivors re-traumatized. Dissenters punished. And silence, strategic suffocating silence, from those in power. When Duluth Vineyard came forward with the truth, Vineyard USA's internal response was carefully crafted. When Ann Arbor Vineyard sent a letter asking the national team to step down and implement real accountability, Vineyard USA responded the same way, with a copy and paste statement. Quote, "We will not be calling for the resignation of any leaders. God has chosen, God has called, and God has commissioned this team for this season." When a small group of leaders believe they're appointed directly by God, what hope is there that they'll ever step down, even when churches call for reform? Let's be clear. Ann Arbor Vineyard wasn't expelled for theology or ideology. They were calling for accountability. They sent a letter asking the national team to step down and implement concrete policy changes to protect against future harm. The response wasn't conversational, it was control. Even when pastors tried to engage in good faith, leaders from Duluth, Ann Arbor, and elsewhere, they were given no answers. They asked Vineyard USA, "What exactly is inaccurate about what we've said?" Vineyard USA gave no clear response. Instead, they published their own curated timeline of events, one that doesn't contradict the core facts, but does require you to submit your name and email address just to access it. This isn't transparency, it's a firewall. And when Ann Arbor lead pastor Donnell Weish pressed for clarity on a specific claim about whether national leaders pressured the church in Duluth to pay the Gatlin severance, the response from Vineyard USA's Rob Morgan wasn't to deny the pressure, only to object to the words insisted and coerced. Donnell's response was clear. Quote, "The facts remain undisputed. I see little value in parsing words." And here's one more thing you won't find in their timeline. Vineyard USA allowed its federal trademark to lapse in March of 2020. Then they re-registered it on March 18th, 2025, less than a month before removing Ann Arbor from the movement by force. Coincidence or strategic preparation? So how will Vineyard USA respond to this episode, to this series? Will it be more silence, more spin, more retaliation? I've already been warned. Quote, "Watch your back. Rich Nathan is vindictive." But here's the thing. If you truly believe you're called by God, if this movement is about more than control, then the next steps are clear. They're difficult, but they are righteous. And if you lead a large Vineyard church, Columbus, Dayton, Cincinnati, Phoenix, Miami, ask yourself, what would happen if just one of you stood up and demanded change? What if several of you did? You could shift the future of the movement. Because here's the reality. Vineyard USA already has almost everything it wants. About 90% of churches have signed on to the reorg. The national office now controls the brand, the ordination process, the governance model. And the rest? They're counting on your silence. So the question isn't whether Vineyard USA is in control. It's whether that's the version of Vineyard you still want to be a part of. We've published our proposals. We've released our assessments. The documentation is there for anyone with the courage to look. The only question now is who's listening. But before we end, I want to say something to the survivors. To the women and men who shared their stories. To the brave staff members who risked their livelihoods to speak truth. To the pastors who were pushed out for asking hard questions. To the people of Duluth, who tried to do the right thing in the face of national indifference. And especially to the memory of the young woman in Duluth who tragically took her own life. Your life mattered, your voice mattered, and you deserved so much more. This story is about more than just theology, more than governance, more than church politics. This is about people. Life's disrupted. Communities broken. Trust violated. This is about the sacred weight of spiritual responsibility and what happens when leaders choose power over people. So if this series has moved you, unsettled you, or made you question what you thought you knew, good. Because change begins with discomfort, and justice begins with truth. This has been season one of Spoiled Fruit, Faith and Power. But the story's not over. In season two, we'll dig even deeper into the roots of institutional betrayal, inside and outside the vineyard. We'll expose more stories, revisit unanswered questions, and investigate what happens when movements put empire before people. If you've stuck with us this far, thank you. And if you want to help us keep going, share the story, tell the truth, and stay loud. I'm John Williamson. Thanks for listening. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily reflect any official policies or positions of any organization mentioned. All claims are based on publicly available information, personal testimony, and investigative research. All subjects discussed are considered innocent until proven guilty in a court of law. This podcast does not offer legal or medical advice. Listener discretion is advised.
Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free, at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.